we were basically just praying. So myself and Ellie Challis are both on Adams. So we purposely put our time slots like at the pool during the races, just in case on the odd chance we were randomly tested. Oh, wow. In case, because if it was at the pool, then it would have counted. Mm. So we were kind of just praying that some drug tester would randomly turn up, but unfortunately they didn't, which means that the world record doesn't count, but it counts as a European record and a British record.
Welcome to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast, where we aim to give swimming the coverage and publicity it deserves. Every week, we celebrate the sport we love with amazing special guests and topics from around the swimming pool. And now, here are your hosts, Scott and Dan.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott, and joining me, as always, is my good friend, Dan. And as usual for this podcast, we are talking all things British swimming with a name whom everyone should really be a lot more familiar with than they most probably are.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're joined by a fantastic athlete this week. And like Scott said, one that everyone in the swimming world should know, and outside of swimming, actually. Scott will talk to you guys through some of her credentials in a second when we bring her on. She's had some incredible achievements, and I feel like she's got more to add to her tally as well.
Yeah. Now, before we get into this week's conversation, just a little gentle reminder, if you are one of our regular listeners on a podcast providing platform like Apple or Spotify, if you could go ahead and leave us a little review, we would greatly appreciate it. Not only does it help this podcast grow, but it will also help kind of just swimming podcasts in general and push them into the wider reaches of the sporting world. Right then, without further ado, please welcome onto the podcast Tokyo 2020 Paralympic champion, 10-time world champion, and European champion, Tully Kearney. Tully, thank you very much for joining us this week. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're good. It's Monday when we're recording this. It already feels like a very, very busy week, but we will soldier on through the dark nights.
Doesn't help when it's getting cold as well, you know, so... But we're good. I think we get quite G'd up for these podcasts, don't we? So we'll find the energy in literally about 5 seconds' time.
So for this podcast today, I think it would be really good for our audience to get to know you just that little bit better. So why don't we start off with your classification in the sport of para swimming? So you swim as an S5, SB4 and SM5 swimmer. So for our listeners who aren't aware with the classification system, what is your disability in the sport and how does it affect your swimming?
So I was born with mild spastic diplegia cerebral palsy, which basically means that my left side is weaker and the muscles in my lower body are really tight, so it affects movement. And then as I started to get older, I started to get some symptoms that weren't typical of cerebral palsy. And after a few years of tests, I was diagnosed with a neurological movement disorder called dystonia. So I have generalized dystonia, and there's many different types, like cerebral palsy, and it affects everyone in different ways. But for me, it causes involuntary muscle spasms and contractures, so it limits my range of movement and my ability to move. So I think the easiest way to explain it to someone is, if you can imagine, you want to activate your hamstring. So for me, if I'm trying to activate my hamstring, my quad also activates, so it makes my leg really difficult to move.
Okay.
Oh, wow. And that must be quite a weird thing to, I don't know, if you focus on activating one muscle, but then another one contracts. Can you describe the feeling of that? Because, of course, we have no idea. Does it feel weird?
Well, it's like you've got two muscles fighting against each other, so it is quite weird. But I found, like, with dystonia, if I focus on moving, the worse my dystonia gets. So I try and focus on contracting a muscle, but also not thinking about it at the same time.
Okay, so it's a lot of muscle memory and reflex kind of movements.
Yeah. Hmm.
So how does it affect you in the pool then? So compared to an athlete like me and Dan, what would your training look like with your condition?
So I wouldn't say we were athletes, but...
This has changed a lot over the years. So my dystonia is progressive, so it's gotten a lot worse as I got older. So I actually started as a S9 swimmer, and as my dystonia got worse, I dropped down classification. So previously, up until about 2016, I was quite mildly affected as an S9. So in the physical category, there's S1 to S10. So S10 is a really minimal impairment. So it might be someone with the lower part of their limb missing, a club foot, mild cerebral palsy, part of their hand missing. So it's a very minimal impairment compared to an able-bodied competitor. So as a 9, obviously, I was quite a minimally impaired athlete. So then it basically, obviously, was weakness on the left side, and I didn't have a full leg kick. So I could still kick, I could still dive and tumble turn, but I just didn't have a full leg kick. And this especially affected me on things like breaststroke. And as it's got worse, it's got to the point now with where my dystonia is at that I have no use of my legs in the water. So I start in the water using a starting device. I'm very lucky, I think, because of all the years of swimming, of the muscle memory, I can still tumble turn, but I can't kick. So now I'm just upper body, and my upper body is also impaired.
So is it gradually going to get worse and worse as well?
Probably. And it's kind of one of the unknowns. With there seems to be a typical trend with developing dystonia, or generalized dystonia specifically, at a young age, like kind of like the age I did, around 13, 14, there seems to be a period where you get a massive decline for 5 years. So if over 5 years, you're rapidly getting worse, and then it kind of stabilizes. So I haven't rapidly got worse for quite a few years now. I've been fairly stable, just with some minor subtle changes. But I think it's kind of expected that slowly over time, I'll get a couple of like more changes, but nothing dramatic, hopefully.
So when you say there's subtle little changes that you're doing, is that reducing training and just concentrating on racing every now and again? Is it focusing on a different sport that isn't swimming?
Kind of all of it. So obviously with having a high level of impairment and with having a lot more muscles that contract when I don't want them to, my fatigue's very high. So we've had to adapt the way I can train. How much I can physically do in a day is drastically different. So I went from like 9 or 10 2-hour sessions a week in the pool to 3 or 4, like 1 hour, 45 minutes to 1 hour sessions. And I haven't actually been able to do that for a while. So it's, you know, it was quite a dramatic change. It was very hard for me to get used to that. And for me, I struggled because I didn't feel like an athlete because I wasn't able. I'd always, like, all these years it had been drawn into my head that to be a swimmer, you've got to swim every day. You've got to do like doubles every day. You've got to do all this stuff, and I can't do it anymore. And that was really hard for me to get my head around, is that how can I feel like an athlete when I can't train? And that was kind of where the athletics came in. So I had a really good friend of mine who I met at university, who's also a sports scholar. She's a paracyclist. She's an amazing girl, Hannah Dines. And she kept saying for me for years, oh, you should come and try frame running. It's this really cool, like, adaptive sport. It's new and, oh, it's really exciting. And I just looked at it like, I'm a swimmer. Why do I want to do athletics?
Swimmers like, don't run.
No. Yeah. And I just looked at it like, I've got, like, because she also has cerebral palsy, but I just looked at it like, you do realise I'm a full-time wheelchair user. Why would I be running? And basically, at the end of 2018, I decided to have bilateral shoulder surgery. So I couldn't swim for about 6 months. And that was really tough for me. I think I'm a typical athlete that I'm quite crazy. Like, I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie and I love training and competing. So for me, the coping mechanism for my disabilities was to swim, because in the water I feel free. I don't feel disabled. Like, as a kid, I could keep up with kids my age, and that's kind of why I fell in love with it. So because that was taken away for so long, I was like, well, I need to find a way of exercising. One, just to keep fit and keep movement, which is really important with neuromuscular disabilities like cerebral palsy and dystonia, because if I'm not using the muscles, I'll lose the ability. So it's really important to keep going some level of fitness. And I thought, well, what's the harm in, you know, going down to the track and seeing what this is all about? So Hannah stored her frame at a track nearby in Stockport. So she took me down to when the wheelchair racing club were training and basically got me on the track with them. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. Like, I've never been able to run. And all of a sudden on this frame, I can literally like run for miles. So it was just really, really cool. So originally it was just to get over surgery. And then I kind of realized that actually this is really helping my fitness. And for me, moving my legs is so much harder than moving my arms because of how stiff my muscles are, that my heart rate is really high compared to what it is in the pool. So it's actually a really easy way for me to build up cardiovascular fitness compared to in the water. I've still got quite a lot of issues, especially with my right shoulder. So unfortunately, I can't train very much in the water because it gets really irritated. And I can't really swim at speed without it getting irritated, which then impacts training. So all of the speed work and high intensity work is generally done on land.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about injuries. With your disability of muscles contracting and involuntary movements as well, do you get injured often? Is it a regular occurrence?
So I was quite lucky in my early career that I didn't really pick up any major injuries until I dislocated my right shoulder at the trials for 2012 Paralympic Games, which, again, took me a long time to recover from. And I was told I probably wouldn't get back to swimming after that and I'd need extensive surgery, but somehow I managed to avoid that. And then it wasn't really until 2015 that I started getting ongoing issues. And I think that was when I started to need to use a wheelchair more. And in the last, probably since about the end of 2016, start of 2017, I've been a full-time wheelchair user. So I need my arms for everything, which obviously increases the load for your arms. So I have had since I had shoulder surgery, I've kind of gone through this trend of, I think it's quite common for athletes, you fix one thing and you find loads of other issues. So I really struggle with my tendons, and obviously there's damage from dislocating my shoulder, damage from swimming all these years from the repetitive overhead movements and needing to use my arms 24/7 to get around. So I've had multiple injuries. There was a point, I think in 2019, I was in the water for a week, out for a month, in for a few days, out for 3 months. Like, I was constantly out of the water with injuries.
So how lucky do you feel that you found this love for essentially frame running, which has given you this fitness base, which you can very quickly fall back on?
Yeah, I think I'm extremely lucky. I think it's quite rare for people with progressive disabilities to get back into the sport after, but then to actually be able to find a way to train in a different sport to help your sport, I think it's quite unique. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful to Hannah, because without her, like, there's no way I would have figured that out. I would never have thought of trying it. And it's not something that my coaches would have immediately gone to, like, oh yeah, let's try cross training. And actually it took me a long time to convince them that actually helped.
It's completely out of the swimming sphere whatsoever, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah. Whereabouts are you training right now? Because I think I've seen on social media you're kind of between Loughborough and Manchester. Is it a bit of a complicated situation?
So obviously there's been a lot of changes within British swimming, and last season my coach of about 7 years was made redundant, and there was a lot of changes with the merge between all of the disciplines of British swimming and a restructure. So at that point, we didn't have a solid coach based in Manchester at the Performance Centre. We had coaches that were travelling and rotating. And there was just, obviously, when you've not got one set coach, there's a lack of communication, and I got quite a bad injury. So I ended up going to Loughborough for 2 weeks because injured athletes aren't allowed in training camps. And when you're at a national centre, if there's a training camp, everyone goes away. There's no one that can train you. So I went to Loughborough and I loved it so much that I asked to stay. So I ended up staying there for about 3 months. But unfortunately, the para swim lead coach there left. So I've come back to Manchester temporarily until December and trying to decide what I want to do.
Temporarily. I was going to ask you, so do you have a rough idea of going back to Loughborough, or are you aiming to stay in Manchester? Do you have a rough idea of what to do?
I keep going back and forth. I think for me, I've got to decide, like, if I want to prioritise performance or mental health. I generally struggle in Manchester's environment that I struggle with. There's a lot that happened pre-Rio, obviously, with my disability getting worse, but also we had a bit of a horrible situation in the centre with the way the coach was. So from that, I actually was diagnosed with PTSD, which for a long time, like, I was in denial about. I was like, how can I have PTSD? I'm just, like, you know, just from a training environment. But I know over time, like, it's quite obvious to me now, and I've accepted it, but I'm always going to struggle in the Manchester environment because of that. And obviously I've worked on it. There's the setup and the environment is very different now. But it's always going to be something that I struggle with, and generally struggle with Manchester. So in Loughborough, I'm just way happier. It's just, I can't, being in a national centre, you've got everything you could ever want or need on site. So obviously going to Loughborough and swimming for Loughborough Uni, we're just trying to figure out how much support I could actually get there and if it's actually feasible for me to go there. And it is basically, do I leave and take a risk that I won't get everything that I need performance-wise, but I'm going to be really happy? And over the summer, I think I've shown that being happy can make me swim way quicker. Or do I stay somewhere where I can get everything I need, but I'm going to be potentially miserable?
Oh, man. It sounds like a tough choice, but I think in my head, I think I'd know. I think mental, like, we speak so much on this podcast about mental health always comes first for us when it comes to whatever we're doing. If we need like just 2 weeks off the podcast, we just take 2 weeks off the podcast. A happy environment is key. So what do you think would be missing then from the Loughborough environment if you were to move there? Because it is a national centre in the sense of the able body, but not for the parago. So what is the difference then?
Well, because obviously there's three national centres for British swimming, Bath, Loughborough and Manchester. Manchester is the only one where para swimmers are currently allowed, but it will be opening up soon to able-bodied swimmers as well. But it's, para swimmers aren't allowed in Bath or Loughborough currently. So moving to Loughborough, being under Loughborough University, so obviously leaving a national centre, you've got everything you could ever want. Your coach is a British swimming coach. Every time you go away, you've got the benefit of your coach being there and not having to have sets written and, you know, have it given to you by a different coach. So obviously you'd lose that contact. Just things like we get so much stuff. So we get soft tissue therapy provided for us in Manchester twice a week, at the minute three times a week, because we don't have a physio because he left. But
so you couldn't get that in Loughborough, even
I can't get soft tissue unless I pay for it. And then I have to pay for training fees to train at Loughborough Uni because I'm not at the uni. So it's just more cost.
Blimey.
Yeah. it's the rehab stuff as well, because obviously each para swimmer will have their own specific like physio stuff as well, and that wouldn't be available at Loughborough, I imagine. And I can't imagine it's cheap, you know?
So I'm quite lucky because I'm a funded athlete. I can get it through the English Institute of Sport. But again, because in Manchester we have everything in-house, we don't have to use the EIS, so... Basically, the way the Institute of Sport works is that each sport has to buy into like each individual area. So because there aren't any para swimmers in Loughborough, we don't buy into it. So it just means that the pot of money would have to be spread throughout everyone on the programme, and it's just adding an extra area for it to be spread through.
Oh, man. I mean, we saw at the Commonwealth Games this summer that there was an integration of the para athletes within kind of the able body. It wasn't just the schedule, it was like the full squads and the full training. So maybe that needs to happen a bit more often. I know you guys have your own specialised training, but there is the resources there.
I think I think some coaches are a little bit worried about para-athletes because, like, understandably, they don't fully understand some of our disabilities and they don't want to injure us or, you know, do something that's wrong. But especially for someone like me with a neurological impairment, there's a lot of people with cerebral palsy over the years that have been overtrained because they've been treated like an amputee or an able-bodied athlete, which is obviously very different. So for someone that's got a visual impairment, an amputee or a learning disability, the rest of their body will work perfectly normally. Whereas someone with a neurological impairment, so cerebral palsy, a brain injury, or someone that's had a stroke, any MS, anything like that, nothing works 100%, so that it takes us longer to recover. And generally, like with cerebral palsy, it takes us a bit longer to get up to where we can actually swim at full speed in training sessions and things. So it's a little bit adapted. So I think some people just get a little bit nervous sometimes.
Yeah, it's learning the disability, because I remember we spoke to Will Perry and we were saying, well, surely things must be different because, you know, the limbs are shorter. And he was like, no, I push myself just as hard as an able body swimmer. I swim 10 times a week. I'm in a gym X amount of times. And he's like, yeah, I eat just as much and everything is just as normal. But of course, for someone with cerebral palsy, like yourself and others, the training will have to be adapted to make it easier, I suppose, or reduced in some sort of way. But it's just learning the different disabilities and going on CPD courses or something like that. I think that's what's required.
So the biggest thing for me is, as my conditions got worse, is that I struggle to swim back-to-back days. So I swim every other day to give me the rest, and then I do gym on my non-swim days. So we just balance things really well.
Well, I hope the situation sorts itself out, because I mean, it's a really tough decision. And I'm not going to make that for you, obviously. But I don't know. I kind of wish it wasn't an all or nothing kind of in terms of national center setups, especially for you para guys, because the para swimming in this country is exceptional, and that knowledge, rather than being one hub, surely it could be spread out a little bit better.
I think that's
might
the plan.
Just have to be
the
first summer to do it, you know.
I think like over quite a few years, I think that's what the plan is, to have all the centres open up to both. But obviously, yeah, that's going to take a lot of time, and I know Loughborough's a bit trickier because of the Loughborough Uni squad to the public, the general uni slots. The pool is used frequently, so having extra pool slots isn't as easy as where, at the minute, obviously, the Manchester Aquatic Centre is being redone for the World Championships, but usually we have a lot more free time in our downstairs pool, so adding an able-bodied centre to the para centre isn't really that much hassle to add on.
Oh, man. If anyone hasn't noticed so far from going through this podcast, you've been through a lot of ups and downs in your career so far. I think there was... Did you withdraw from your first para games in Rio or before it happened? Only then to qualify at Tokyo, and not just qualify, but win golds, hit world records. It must seem like a bit of an emotional roller coaster at times.
Oh, yeah, it certainly has. I think withdrawing from Rio, like, I never thought I'd swim again, never thought I'd be able to go to Paralympic Games. I just thought that, and at that point, my career was over, and the way that my dystonia progressed, I had to relearn how to live independently, how to do everything else myself with my increased level of impairment. So at that point, swimming wasn't really in my mind. And then I eventually got back into it. And I think the turning point is when I went to the European Championships in 2018, like, surprised everyone by qualifying and won a gold and a bronze. And I think that kind of really opened my mind that actually maybe I've got a chance, maybe I can still go to Paralympic Games. And so had the surgery, which was really difficult to recover from, and surprised everyone. Well, not my coach. My coach knew what I'd do. He always used to come up to me, and he always used to tell me, like, I don't want to put any pressure on you. He told me in 2015, he came up to me before, and I was feeling a bit disheartened. I'd only qualified for the relay, didn't actually qualify, didn't actually hit the qualifying target for Worlds. And he said to me, you do realise if you swim well, you could be like the highest medal earner for GB. And I looked at him like, are you crazy? And it came true. So like he always just knew, like, never underestimated, he knew exactly what I could do. So that obviously really helped me. And going out towards Tokyo, I was so nervous because I had to withdraw a week before Rio, and I had an injury going into Tokyo, quite a bad injury, and I was really struggling. So it was in my head, I was like, oh my God, like, what if I have to withdraw again? What if I don't get there? And I wasn't really excited until we actually landed in Tokyo. And then I was like, oh, I've made it to Tokyo. Surely nothing can go wrong now.
Got the monkey off your back sort of thing.
Yeah, so then I started to get more excited.
God, we were right with the emotional roller coaster then. It really is up and down all the time then. It's not just for the Paralympics. It's almost every day with training. Like, it must be immensely fatiguing as well as physically fatiguing as well.
Yeah, it's quite frustrating. With the nature of having a condition like dystonia, I can be quite different day to day. I can be amazing on like a Monday, and then I get to the pool on Friday and I can't clear the water. So yeah, I think it's difficult for the coaches to understand as well, especially working with new coaches, because they look at me and they're like, what has happened in like 2 days? So yeah, it's been frustrating. It's been a learning curve. But I think for me as well, like, it's kind of shown me that, you know, so many people have, you know, certain disabilities or have issues in their life where they kind of put limits on themselves, like, oh, well, I'm not going to be able to do this now, or, you know, this is never going to happen, or, like, what's the point in trying? And I think I've kind of proven that, obviously, it took me, like, 5 years longer and it looked very different and it was really difficult to get there, but obviously I still achieved my goal, which was, like, to be honest, I wasn't really caring about medals. I just wanted to be able to call myself a Paralympian. And obviously I achieved that, so I think for me it was kind of an eye-opener, especially to get the word out about dystonia, which is why I became patron of Dystonia UK, which is the only UK-based charity, to help people with the condition of dystonia and just to, like, show others that, you know, it is still possible.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many points in the journey that you've told us so far where you've literally said, I wasn't meant to swim again, sort of thing. And yet you've kept going, and five or 6 years later at Tokyo, you're winning golds. It's incredible.
It's a journey, isn't it? Amazing.
I'm going to take you back to another little bit of a roller coaster in last summer. Now, it caught our eye at the British Summer Champs in Sheffield, where you set an unbelievable world record. I think you smashed the mark by over a second, if I'm correct. But unfortunately, because there was no doping control there, the world record doesn't stand. It's a very odd one in the fact that, obviously, you're a world-class swimmer. You're there. You're racing. There is a chance that you could set world records because you've set them in the past. And yet, because this... it's almost an arbitrary thing that wasn't set in place for you, it doesn't count. What was your reaction to that?
To be honest, I was really disappointed. At first, like, it was about a month after the World Championships, and generally, because of my shoulder, I struggled to recover after racing. So, I mean, I was injured during Tokyo, but it took me 20 weeks to get back in the water after Tokyo. So I wasn't really expecting to be able to race, but luckily we managed to get me back in. And I wasn't expecting to, you know, swim quick, but the head coach said to me, like, I want you to move it on from Worlds. And at Worlds, I broke 3 world records. So I was like, okay. It was the night before it started. Obviously, you've got the technical meeting. And one of the Loughborough coaches, because I was still based in Loughborough, then phoned me and was like, they're not accepting world records. And I was like, what? So I didn't realise that the rule is actually slightly different for the Olympic guys and the Paralympic side. So for us in paraswimming, if you break a world record, it's not you that individually has to be tested, it's anyone during that meet. So if a single person is tested randomly during the competition, then it will count. Whereas for the Olympic side, it's the person that breaks the world record that has to be tested. So it is quite different. And I don't know why it's different.
That doesn't make any sense to me, like at all, but okay, yeah.
So I think, like, obviously, from the able-bodied side, all the guys that would be capable of breaking world records would be at Commonwealth Games. So it was only really the para side where it would be an issue. So there were two of us, myself and Ellie Challice, that were potentially going to break world records. So I know British Paraswimming tried really hard to contact them to try and get someone from UCAD down. And when they were advised that they couldn't send anyone because they were too busy with the Commonwealth, because it was a couple of weeks, well, not even, I think it was about, it started about maybe a week or so before the Commonwealth.
Yeah, it was a good week.
Something
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
So obviously most of the teams were in the country and they wanted to do like pre-competition testing and, you know, like the random testing they do. So the next option for British Swimming was to contact one of the private. So if UCAD can't come, you can then contact a private drug testing company and pay for them to come to the event. So they tried that, and again they said, oh, we can't because we're too busy with the Commonwealth. So then what we tried next is, I'm actually on Adam's, it's a whereabouts, so I get randomly drug tested in and out of competition. So we were like, well, I'm frequently drug tested, can we go off that? And they were like, absolutely not. So we were basically just praying. So myself and Ellie Challice are both on Adams. So we purposely put our time slots at the pool during the races, just in case on the odd chance we were randomly tested. Oh, wow. Because if it was at the pool, then it would have counted. Mm. So we were kind of just praying that some drug tester would randomly turn up, but unfortunately they didn't, which means that the world record doesn't count, but it counts as a European record and a British record.
What?
So the British record is faster than the world record.
Yeah.
Utterly madness. Did it take a while for you to get over it? Well, how did you get over it?
I think for me, the biggest frustration was I'd been working so well with Gareth McNary in Loughborough, who was the Paralympic coach. And it was my first, so I raced obviously at Worlds, but he didn't come. So it was the first time where he was there and he could see me break world records. And he also was finishing his career as a swim coach and going to lecturing. So I really wanted that to be under, you know, the last thing that happens is that one of his athletes sets a world record. And then the fact that it doesn't count. And I was just like, oh. So I think I was more frustrated, not that it didn't count as a world record, because obviously I'm going to beat it again, hopefully. But it was more that it was the sentiment of like the only time I get to race under Gareth and in the UK under a British meet and it won't count.
Oh man, that's a really selfless attitude, actually. That's yeah. amazing. Yeah. And you say it gives you confidence that you can smash it again. No doubt now.
I had an injury going into Worlds, which is why I was in Loughborough, and we worked really well through it. And I was kind of wasn't really sure where I'd be at, but we kind of changed things up. So we did the opposite of what we did during Tokyo. So in the water, instead of so before Tokyo, we did low level volume, but we just tried to really push the intensity, and it just did not work. And it meant that the effectiveness of the steroid injection I had to get for the injury just didn't work. So I was in pain constantly, and that made racing really difficult. So what we did for the World Championships was really low level and low intensity, getting to the maximum I got to was like threshold. Not going any quicker than that, but just doing really high intensity, slightly shorter sessions on the track. And that worked really, really well. So obviously it gave me confidence at Worlds, but I never thought that my times that I did at the World Championships, like I'd be able to go quicker. Like I think it was about 4 or 5 weeks later. And the 100 freestyle, the world record that I broke in Sheffield, was almost 2 seconds quicker than what I did at Worlds.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's crazy. So when you have like your list of PBs, for example, that time must be in like an asterisk, because I've done this time, but it doesn't officially count on the world stage. Like, what time do you enter now for like the next Paralympics in like Paris?
Yeah, this is really weird. I was talking to my current coach about it, and because we're entering, I've got a winter national meet coming up, and then we're doing the Northampton meet 2 weeks after. And I said to him, like, what time do I enter? And he's like, well, because it still counts, even though it's not technically, like, it's not international level, it does count as a PB. It just obviously doesn't count as a world record. So I'd still enter that quick time. But I'm hoping maybe at trials I might be ready to push on and try and beat it.
Mm. That'd be a really easy way to confuse some poor commentator at the Paralympics. Yeah. when the world records come up, but your entry time is faster. That'd be a really easy way.
They'll be like, what? What's going on? It's a glitch.
So what is the target this summer? Because the Worlds are in Manchester. They're in your home country. What's the target?
To be honest, just getting to... I think... I obviously want to retain my three titles. So I retained them twice now. So I'd really like to do it three times. That'd be really cool. And the aquatic center is the pool that I've been training at for the last 7 years. So it's my home pool. I think for me, I've had a bit of a rocky start to this career. I kind of thought that after Tokyo, I might retire just because of how difficult it's been with my shoulder. And obviously I decided that it just kind of reignited my love for sport. I just absolutely love racing, and I just don't get to do it much because of my shoulder, which is kind of why I was falling out of love with the sport a little bit. And I was just generally unhappy. But it kind of, one, I never want to be beaten by the Chinese girl again. Like, don't want anyone to ever beat me. That's giving me a massive to go win two golds and not be beaten. I also want to experience the games in a pandemic where there's actually spectators and there's stuff to do in the village and you're not scared about like speaking to anyone in case you become a close contact and get dragged away. So I decided to carry on, but obviously like I've still got these ongoing shoulder issues, and last season was better until I got the injury. So I decided, you know, like, why don't I go see a shoulder surgeon, just see exactly what's going on, get a more in detailed scan. And I didn't really get the response I was expecting, and it wasn't that long ago, it was a couple of months ago. And not even that, actually. And I was told that I should immediately retire from swimming. So,
oh, wow.
So it's okay. Kind of made me think about things. And basically, like, the issues with my shoulder are irreparable. Like, it's just something I've got to live with. And he was just basically concerned that if I keep doing high-load overhead activities like swimming, that by the time I get to 40 years old, that I won't be able to self-propel, or, you know, like, I won't have much shoulder function left. So... it's kind of given me something to think about. And, you know, originally I was really upset. I wasn't expecting to be told that I needed to retire immediately. But, you know, we've got a really good team doc, and I've been speaking to them, speaking to coaches and other athletes. And I don't feel like it's my time. I feel that we can manage this well. Obviously, I've got the advantage of cross-training. And I feel like if we manage it well, I think, hopefully, I can get to Paris. And, I mean, my goal has always been to go to a Commonwealth Games. And as a lower-class athlete... like, they don't put the lower classifications in. So the lowest they go is an S6. So unless there happened to be a freestyle event, because you can only swim up one category, unless there was an S6 freestyle event, I don't ever have a chance of competing in one. So I was kind of hoping that I could hold on till 2026 just to see, in case of the odd chance, that there is an S6 women's freestyle event that I could potentially swim up in.
Well, let's talk about these Commonwealth Games because, yeah, you didn't get to race this summer, which is it's tough because there really isn't enough events for para swimming. But you decided to volunteer. So what was that like being at the pool when you've got teammates racing? Was that tough?
Yeah, it was really, really tough. I mean, for me, like, I'm just a natural racer. Like, I love racing. So to be on poolside and watch other para swimmers race, but no, I can't, was really, really tough. So the first 2 days I actually spent in the crawl room checking athletes in so I didn't have to watch them race.
Okay.
So I think for me, like, the biggest thing, like, obviously I grew up in Birmingham. My whole sporting career started in Birmingham, that I wanted to be part of it. Like, it's my hometown. I wanted to be part of the Commonwealth Games. And obviously if I can't do that in an athlete aspect, then why not volunteer and see what it's about? I think a lot of us are guilty of, especially me, because I've had so many issues, especially with shoulders and worrying about fitness and that at big meets, I'd never actually stopped to think about how much volunteers do and how much of a necessity they are. And I didn't even realise how, in an international competition, I got given the best role that there is, which everyone wants a field of place role for volunteering, but no one gets it. Like, you have to volunteer at least 10 times to get this role. And because I'm an athlete, they gave it to me straight away without even questioning. Wow. But I didn't realise how important that role is and how, like, actually how difficult it is to fulfil that role.
I was literally going to say that the sport literally relies on volunteers, otherwise it just wouldn't work at all. You wouldn't have any judges, no timekeepers, no nothing on poolside, because, you know, we literally, the sport is run by them. Would you recommend it to others that aren't able to compete to soak up the atmosphere like you did?
Oh, definitely. It obviously gives you, especially for young athletes coming up that haven't been to a big event, it will give you the insight into what, how loud it is, what it looks like, how everything's run. I think it's a really big learning curve for other athletes to appreciate how much volunteers do, because I think we're all guilty of not really knowing or taking the time to actually see how much they do and how much goes into it. And it's really, actually really interesting to see the other side of it and not always just be the athlete.
Mm-hmm. Before we finish this podcast, I'm going to ask you kind of a really tough question. If the shoulder doesn't hold up, is there a future for frame running? Would you look at doing another sport at the Paralympics?
So this is interesting because a couple of years ago, when I first started, I was trying to get classified in frame running and I just couldn't because it was covered by Cerebral Palsy Sport, which is UK based, and CPISA, which is the international version, basically Cerebral Palsy Sport. And they headed up all the classifications. So they decided that they wanted to get it in the Paralympic Games. So they would swap it over to the IPC and British Athletics. Well, there was a bit of a miscommunication and they were basically, no one was classified for about 3 years. No, like, either side wouldn't classify anyone. And it meant that when they applied for it to be included in Paris, that the IPC refused to put it in because there weren't enough people classified. So okay. I got really frustrated because there's all these people that do the sport, but we can't, like, we weren't classified because no one would classify us, but then they wouldn't put us in the Paralympic Games because there weren't enough of us. So that was quite frustrating.
Like, back to thinking, isn't it?
So we're hoping that, obviously, because I was hoping to try and be a dual sport athlete at Paris. Mm. That would have been really cool. But no, you know, hopefully it will get put into LA. That's something I want to try. But my original plan was actually to do a triathlon after Paris and see if I could do triathlon. However, I bought a hand bike and a charity called the Be More Bailey Charitable Foundation really kindly helped fund that. And unfortunately, I started to try and use it on rollers while I was in Loughborough. And I can cycle to about 1K until I get a lot of shoulder pain. And the sprint distance on a triathlon is 20K.
Oh, wow. That's quite far.
What? That's a sprint distance. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's the shortest triathlon. And it's about 750-meter swim, a 5K push in a racing chair, and then a 20K bike. So, yeah, don't think that's going to work.
Oh, jeez.
But maybe wheelchair racing. We'll see. But I think frame running, obviously, shoulder-wise, is much better. And I'm always going to do it. It's something, like, I can go on dog walks, like, places my wheelchair can't get. I can just generally use it. And my biggest passion at the minute is trying to get young kids into it as early as possible, because we have a club in Manchester, which is amazing. And if I do move, I'd really love to set up my own club in Loughborough. But the difference between a young lad in Birmingham, who I fundraised to buy a frame for, he finally got his frame at the age of 8, but he'd never walked, never had a walker because he can't sit unaided. So the difference between them and the, we've got a couple of 4 and 5 year olds in our club in Manchester, and that early intervention makes such a massive difference. And obviously not all these kids are going to be athletes, but them being able to go to a sport club, experiencing everything like everyone else, being treated like a normal kid and actually have the benefit of being physically active, something that they'd never be able to do. These kids can't walk unaided. They're pushed around all days. They're too young to have electric chairs or self-propel. So they're fully reliant on everyone. And then you get them on a track and they're running laps. And I think that is just so important to start at such a young age. So that's like the main thing I'm really interested in at the minute, is trying to get as much awareness for that as possible.
See, more people need... we need more people like you, Tully. More selfless people who just want to help young kids who maybe don't have the financial backing, or the, you know, they're not able to get to places. It's yeah, everything like that. The credit to everything, I think. More people need to get to know you, Tully, honestly. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast, honestly.
So we do usually finish our podcast with some quick fire questions for our elite guests. Do you sound up for those?
Okay.
So what is your favourite event in swimming?
100 freestyle.
Who is your swimming idol?
Can it be someone who's retired?
Yeah.
It was Jazz Carlin.
Oh, nice. What's your proudest moment in swimming?
Winning gold in Tokyo, but not just because it was a Paralympic medal, because of everything I went through to get there.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. What's the hardest set you've ever done in training? And I'm mindful that your training probably has to be specially written for you and your disability.
Back in the day when I was at boarding school, every Monday morning we either did 3100 freestyle off 115 or 10 400s IM.
That's pretty good. That's tough.
Scott couldn't make that.
No, not a chance. And if you were to go on a road trip, there's 3 spaces in the car. You can take friends, family, or celebrities. Who would you take with you? It's a completely random question that helps.
I think I'd take one celebrity, one member of my family, and one friend.
Okay. Have you got any names in mind for the celebrity?
I don't really know. It wouldn't be an athlete, I don't think.
Okay.
So that's someone cool and interesting.
So many names, isn't there? It's always a tough one.
Put you on the spot. Tully, thank you so much for coming on to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. I've thoroughly enjoyed learning a lot more about your story. This 45 minutes has actually just flown by. Best of luck with the rest of the season. Hopefully we see you at the World Championships later on this or next year. Hopefully the shoulder holds up for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, best of luck both in swimming and in frame running as well, because it seems like you've got a bit of career in both at the moment. So best of luck to both of those disciplines, and we should definitely keep in touch because it's been great.
So that just about rounds up this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And me and Dan will be back in 1 week's time.
Yeah, thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next one.
You've been listening to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast with Scott and Dan. We want to thank you for joining us and invite you to subscribe to the show, as well as checking out the Propulsion Swimming YouTube channel for weekly tutorials and videos to get your swimming fix. We will be back next week. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.